Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Leonora Walters, and joining me today are personal finance writer Kate Bailey and special guests Darius McDermott, Managing Director at Chelsea Financial Services, and Carl Harald Jansen, Manager of International Biotechnology Trust. Over the past 10 years, biotech shares have done really well, so Kate has recently been looking at this area. Kate, is this a good area for investors to get into?
Well, yeah, biotech's been a real phenomenal performer in the past kind of 10 years. So the Nasdaq biotech index has soared and returned kind of around 500% in 10 years, which is double the Nasdaq composite index. And the trusts and funds which invest in this area come top of their categories and indeed of all closed-ended and open-ended funds over the long term. So I think the main question for investors and for you, Carl, is can this continue, this rise and rise in biotech?
Yeah, I am absolutely convinced that this will rise over the long term. You mentioned 10 years. If you go back 20 years, you know, the biotech sector has done 12+% growth per year in the stock market, healthcare about 9-10, and the general stock market 7. And I think the drivers are still in place for the similar type of development over the next 10 to 20 years, meaning that this particular subsector will outperform the stock market in general, and also within healthcare will be the leading sector.
And what are those drivers?
The main drivers are top line. You know, this sector is driven by top line growth, and then of course that materializes into earnings growth, and the projections for the next 5 years between 2015 to 18 is approximately 16.5% EPS growth for the larger biotech companies in the US. And at a PE multiple of approximately 20 for 16, this is, I think, a good proposition. And we see this earnings growth continue through top line, meaning new drugs coming to the market.
So that's what's driving the main growth, is it? Kind of more drugs, more sales of drugs at a very simplistic level.
Yeah, and behind that is this kind of complete shift in the scientific advancements that we see as an accelerating knowledge about diseases that we are seeing, you know, basic science trying to understand, and now understanding what genes, what proteins are involved in diseases like schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, that we hadn't had a clue about. And that's a good starting point to make new drugs.
Because, I mean, I think the thing that worries people about this market, and we hear the word bubble used a lot in relation to biotech, and I think the concern is that there are kind of so many IPOs and so much M&A activity, particularly with companies which don't even have a drug to bring to market. I think in the US last year, something like 40% of IPOs were for companies at preclinical stage. I mean, is that a concern?
I agree that there's some frothiness in parts of this market. What I mentioned, the P evaluations, that's for the earnings growth stories and companies that, and that's kind of give a solid valuation base to the market, and also the low interest rate that we have and probably going to have for longer term is going to kind of keep the stock market at this type of valuation. But what you are mentioning is, you know, the small caps, the earlier research companies where there is a lot of expectations for future earnings. Depending on results. And I see frothiness in some areas. Some areas are always hyped. Some areas are always like in.
Which are the hyped areas?
Well, hyped areas, as I see it, is like cell therapy for cancer. You know, companies with less than 100 patients treated, trading at over $2 billion valuation. Mm. These things we don't like very much. We don't invest very much in that yet. I really want to see, you know, good solid data and in a quite a good number of patients, so you know it's not going to be any tox or anything. So we try to avoid those subsectors, but definitely, you know, there are some subsectors that are very highly valued and others that are not.
And which are the ones that are not then? Where's the good value in biotech?
I think, you know, from a risk reward perspective, like anti-infectives and antivirals are less risky, but still there is a big need.
And what kind of stocks, what companies would those be?
On the large caps, we've seen like Gilead buying from asset for $11 billion 3 years ago and launched, you know, the new hepatitis C drug that's selling for more than $10 billion and the whole sector for $20. So we like that type of companies. We're also in the research area, new antibiotics for pneumonia and other diseases that, you know, 100 years were quite deadly. And now we pay, you know, £2 to get treated. But the problem is that these bugs are becoming resistant. So those types of improved with antibiotics, where you know the mechanism and everything, there is much less risk, but are underappreciated, I think.
Okay, so I mean, what do you think is one of the most exciting new developments in biotech which you are investing in?
Well, if you think about the new, I think, you know, then what happened yesterday is what what I could focus on, and that's I think the more data in the Alzheimer's area. I was always in the camp that you can't invest in Alzheimer's because there are absolutely no drugs in development that could cure the disease because we don't know what it is. There are no animal models and so on. But for the first time, I moved from that camp into the camp of believing that there might be new drugs that could actually change the course of Alzheimer's disease. And I'm thinking mainly of Biogen's drug and Lilly's drug in development. Data, for example, for the 10 milligram dose for the Biogen drug between 6 and 12 months, where there was no deterioration of the disease. I think it's a dose response and a low number of patients, and still we see all this, all comes together that I moved from one camp to another. I think, you know, in Alzheimer's, we might in a couple of years see the first drug emerge that could change the course of the disease.
So will you be investing in that drug?
Of course.
And are you now invested in it?
Or? We are invested in Biogen, for example, that has, I think, the strongest data.
And so you'll be upping your kind of exposure to that, will you?
I don't comment on, you know, how we manage the portfolio. One thing is, you know, what you think is a good drug, a good company and so on. Then it's another thing is, you know, how you manage your investments in a particular stock. Over the course of the year, there are also the short term for Biogen in specific some new data on progressive MS that, you know, could be very risky, and in stroke for another drug. So maybe the stock could react in a different way than our hopes for Alzheimer's. You know, you have to separate that.
Okay, so I mean, and more widely, do you think there will be a correction coming in biotech, and how are you positioned for that if it happens?
So the correction in the stock market, because I don't think there will be a correction in biotech separate from the whole stock market. And I believe, you know, in fundamental valuation. So for me, it's the interest rate that is one of the most important factors, not so much geopolitical risk. Usually it's the interest rate. And we are in a cycle of starting to increase interest rates, like in the US, Yellen is talking now about September or December or January. There is always some turbulence when you start to increase the interest rates. So that there could be some turbulence when that happens 3 months in advance or so. But on the other hand, the market has also, I think, looking at the longer term growth of the interest rates or increase. And now midterm from the Feds is more like lower than 2% interest rates. So we're going to go from 0 to 1.8. It's not going to be, you know, extremely high interest rates anyway. So I think the setback that we might see might be short-lived in a way. But of course, there are always corrections all the time.
But you don't think that these kind of frothier elements of the biotech sector will see a correction, you know, which won't impact
other
areas?
If there will be a correction, I think the stocks that will correct most are the ones that are in the small cap area that you just mentioned, you know, this one, the research that don't have any drugs or anything, while Gilead or Biogen with a PE valuation that, you know, I mentioned for 16 is, and for the sector is 20 on earnings
and
growth.
And so those
16.
Companies have very strong earnings.
You still have. And also something we haven't talked about is the M&A. We have a lot of M&A going on. It's always it's an M&A rich area, but in particular now you can see that small caps, mid caps, you know, companies without drugs or drugs, you know, in the late stage or just launched, they pay, you know, big price for this. It's a high price. I mean, that also supports the market because there are all of these candidates, takeout candidates, that people still will think, you know, they will go at a higher price. So any correction for those particular stocks will be short-lived also. We look a lot on M&A when we invest, so see, you know, what companies are fully owned, have a wholly owned asset, you know, will fit with another company and so on. So those, that is also a value creation thing that supports part of the, we have just a Receptos being acquired by Celgene, and we have had other stocks that have been doing very well on M&A this year.
Okay. I mean, Darius, what do you think? How risky do you think this sector is, and how much do you like it?
Yeah, I mean, we would tend to be concerned about valuation at premiums, and that more volatile sectors like biotech, that if there is a correction in markets, that you might expect the biotech sector to underperform, maybe only for a short term. as Carl has mentioned. And I think the other key thing that Carl's sort of brought to the discussion today is that it's a varied and wide sector with some good cash generative earnings companies on reasonable valuations, and then sort of unheralded technologies that are in hot areas of the market that have gone very, very expensive. And I think for me, the key thing is that on a sector like biotech, more than ever, you need solid, active management where a manager can differentiate between those types of companies, maybe than rather just buying an ETF in the sector or something like that, where you would be exposed to all areas of the market. So I do think biotech is the quality biotechs are not super expensive for that top line earnings growth that Carl's described.
Yeah, just finally, I mean, funds in that area of concentrated in one sector, what percentage of perhaps an investor's portfolio could a dedicated biotech fund account for?
Well, certainly, you know, we view single sector funds as higher risk than broad market, clearly, and more volatile sectors like biotech, sort of pretty much single sector stuff like that, do carry the highest sort of risks on a fund by fund comparison. So biotech is not for every investor. I think it's for investors who've got at least a medium to long-term outlook, positive on the sector. And if you are a medium or higher risk investor, you could allocate up to 5%. We never say more than 5% for any single sector or single thematic type of view, because if you have global managers or US managers, they're going to have some exposure to biotech very likely anyway. But I think 5% is a more than generous allocation, but for investors who are able to, you know, ride that volatility out, which we have seen historically.
Okay, thanks. Some interesting insights there. This week's Portfolio Clinic features a couple looking to build up a pension pot to give them a set annual income in retirement over a period of 3 to 5 years. Darius, if you're trying to give your retirement pot a final boost over such a short time period, what kind of investment strategies could you adopt?
Yeah, I mean, historically, you might expect people coming closer to retirement to take less risk. You will have built a pot of money and you wouldn't want to see it frittered away in a 2008 financial crisis where markets were down between 30 and 40% globally. So you do need to appreciate that if you are taking a more aggressive strategy to try and give it a last couple of years boost, that actually you are taking that sort of inherent risk to the value of your pension pot. I mean, frankly, there's sort of taking more risk or investing more money are the only two simple things that you can do to boost your pot. Given all the pension tax changes that are coming, you know, making additional investments in this current tax year would seem a sensible starting point. And then really, from an investment strategy point of view, you know, markets generally look fairly valued globally. There's no real standout areas of really good value. We favour Japan and Europe, certainly over the next 12, 24 months, supported by better valuations than in the States. But more importantly, they're being supported by quantitative easing, which certainly post-financial crisis has been a really strong driver of markets at having QE.
Okay. And for the strategy, you know, what sort of asset allocation could the overall portfolio have? And what kind of funds could you use to put it into action?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, one of the key things that people historically would have done is as they approached the crystallization effect of wanting to take that pension pot, they would generally de-risk. But given longevity, I mean, people are, you know, living to sort of 80, 85 very regularly now. So you need your pension pot to actually provide for longer. So sort of de-risking coming into sort of 60 or 65, I think probably is actually more risky because you need this pension pot to be able to provide an income for the longer term. Hence, you do need to keep some growth in it. So either having more growth rather than income strategies in the early years of taking a pension pot, or sort of running like a barbell type strategy where you have a portion of the pot paying an income and a portion of the pot dedicated to growth. I like some of the higher income funds that you can get from the likes of Schroder Income Maximizer or Fidelity Enhanced Income, where they are equity based strategies, but they actually sell away some potential growth to give you a premium income. I quite like that strategy for income takers. Now, clearly that portion won't grow as much as broader equities because they're giving you that premium income. Then, you know, we're very negative on bonds. I'm afraid we've been early stroke wrong with that view, but it's been very consistent throughout the entire investment management community that the bonds... So I don't favour bonds. Clearly, that doesn't mean you have no bonds in a portfolio because they do act as a good diversifier and they can still give you some income. We like funds like Henderson Strategic Bond, which is still paying nearly 5% income. 24 Asset Management Dynamic Bond is another fund which is paying around that 5%. That also has a little bit of diversification in the fund because it actually does some asset-backed securities, which again are less correlated to the bond market and less sensitive to interest rate rises that appear to be now well forecasted for later this year, maybe early next year in the US and the UK.
Okay, some really useful tips there. In our money section this week, Kate has also been looking at building up sums of money over a set time period, but for a different purpose, paying school and university fees. Kate, first of all, why is it a good idea to save up for education fees in advance?
Well, at a very basic level, because education is very expensive if you are going private. Private school fees have gone up again, as have boarding school fees. And also university fees are increasing. Apparently the average private school fee now is over £13,000 a year. Average boarding school fee over £30,000. And we've got tuition fees of up to £9,000. So, I mean, just on a basic level, this is going to be a massive cost if you want to pay for it. And you need to kind of start saving early.
What kind of sums do you need to build up and how much a year would you need to save?
Well, I think we've kind of broken it down into looking at this over a long and shorter term time horizon, because part of the issue here is that I guess you don't know necessarily how many children you'll have and what schools they might get into. So obviously the ideal is you have a long kind of time frame for this, maybe over 10 years, particularly if your child will start private school at 11. And so then what you want to be doing is saving around £500 a month. And Darius, we talked about this, didn't we?
Yep.
And to build up a pot of around 76,000, which could then, you know, you could then pay for that child. I mean, in an ideal world, what you'd want to do is save up and have a portfolio, an investment portfolio, and then the yield off that would pay fees, but you would need such a large pot, wouldn't you?
Well, you would. Even in today's rate, getting a 5% yield from any form of investment pot is stretching it. That sort of £500 is sort of, I think, a minimum. Mm. The point about starting early is you get the benefit of compounding, and that growth compounds from year to year. We quite like sort of just good old fashioned income funds. For this type of strategy, because you've got the certainty of some dividend. Hope most income funds now also target dividend growth, so you're getting some growth in that dividend. And if you can do that for 10 years, and if we take the presumption of presuming sort of a 5 to 6% annual return after fees, then sort of that £500 a month does get you to the sort of £75,000 type of pot, or sort of £750 a month takes you to the sort of £120,000 pot. But that clearly is per child.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the point Kate made earlier was excellent. Private education is very expensive, and clearly then the earlier you start to make some form of saving towards it, and potentially university as well, the better, because with university, if you start saving for a child from 18, you know, you've got 18 years, and then you've got a really long period of time to enjoy some growth and some compounding.
I guess the slight difference here with saving for something like this, which has a very finite time frame, doesn't it? As in the amount of time you'll be paying out is set. It's not like saving for retirement in that sense, where you might need the money for longer than you think. So if you do have to kind of erode the capital as well as taking the income, that's not the worst thing in the world, as long as you know that you have enough to cover it.
Well, exactly. And I think you're quite right on school fees. In an ideal world, you'd have a pot big enough that you just take the yield off of it and the pot would continue. But realistically, you're going to have to draw down. Now, you could, if you had a decent sized pot at over a 10-year period, you could convert it to a more income strategy and then just draw some capital to make up the fees each year. Or you just keep a high growth strategy and you just cash in a certain portion of it each year to pay down those school fees.
But then I think that the other scenario is obviously that you've got a very short term time frame, either because you want to send the child to school at five, or you know, it's kind of a sudden decision. And I think in that case, you don't really have enough time, do you, to be in the stock market and make enormous gains?
So yeah, maybe, I mean, if you've got sort of 3 or 5 years, I'm afraid there is no magic cure. The only way to achieve either that size of pot is to make substantially more greater contributions and potentially take more risk. And the other side of taking more risk is if you go into a period of weak markets, and we've certainly seen plenty of those in my 20 years in investments, that you know, you actually take more risk at exactly the wrong time. So there's no magic wand. What rabbit can I pull out of the hat to meet these pots with shorter time periods? You just need to invest more. Again, you want to be balanced. We quite like absolute return funds as well, where maybe you've got less market risk. There are some good funds out there, the likes of Henderson UK Absolute Return, or Smith & Williamson Enterprise Fund. They're just UK funds which buy shares that they like and sell shares that they don't like, but they get this netting off effect, and they're much less correlated to equities. And historically, you know, they've returned pretty handsome, sort of 6-8% per annum. If you sort of couple that with some income funds, maybe a global income fund, something like Artemis Global Income Fund, you know, you can find that you've got a sort of a broad geographic exposure and some asset class exposure as well.
Yeah, I think something that quite a few people said was what you might want to do in this scenario is just save as much as you possibly can to a cash ISA over 5 years, but also be saving into a stocks and shares, which will maybe pay out over the longer term.
There are different times in the cycle where cash is very attractive. At 0.5, it is not. So I would rather do anything but cash. If you said to me, we've got to attack it now for 3 to 5 years from today, if interest rates were at 5%, 5% is a very handsome compounded return with zero risk up to your sort of financial services compensation scheme limit. But at this moment in time where we sit, and interest rates have yet to rise, I'm slightly sceptical it will happen in the UK this year. So I think if we were taking lower risk, something like an absolute return, some of these funds that I've mentioned have got good long-term track records of delivering above 5% with lower correlation to equities. I'm not saying, you know, if equities are down 20, they won't be down a bit, 2, 3, 4%, but much less than equities. And, you know, if equities are up 20, also they're unlikely to be up 20. They're likely to be up that sort of 5 to 8% per annum, which sounds fairly healthy. Lower risk, but still with some risk type of return. So that, as I say, along with an income fund where you've at least got your dividend and some dividend growth, seems like a good starting portfolio for this type of strategy, even on the shorter term.
Mm. Yeah, on the flip side, people who are just looking to save for their kids' university fees so they don't end up with big debts have potentially up to 18 years, which gives a lot more freedom and a lot more options.
Yeah.
What sort of things can parents do to, you know, build up a decent pot for the kids going to uni?
Yeah, I mean, again, in this sort of instance where you've got a longer term, I would certainly give a greater allocation to faster growing markets. That's the sort of thing where you could consider an allocation to something like biotech, which we just previously discussed, but for my mind, much more into sort of broad Asia and emerging markets. These are fast growing countries. Generally, with faster growing countries and GDP support, you have at least support for potential stock market growth. But again, even in the last decade, we've seen sort of a fantastic rise in emerging markets. And more recently, some of them have been really poor performers. The poor performing markets clearly have been Russia and Brazil and China over the last 3 weeks. But, you know, China was up a huge amount from sort of in the previous year and the year before that, India. But broad Asian funds, things like First State Asia Pacific Leaders, Hermes, Asia X Japan, these have got good experienced managers. And, you know, they had very, very strong returns last year. So the higher growth markets do, again, come with a bit more volatility. But over that 18-year period, I think we can ride out that volatility. And again, if you're saving into these things on a monthly basis where they are more volatile, and 1 month the market is, say, one, the next market it's at 0.8, you actually get more units every time you buy when markets are down. So you get that averaging of pound cost averaging, which can help it. And I think for 18 years, again, I would be very, very strongly recommending that people look at equities over cash, particularly again with low interest rates. I wouldn't say if interest rates are at 5, certainly have a portion in cash because you've got that sort of safety, lower risk. But with that longer term, I think we can do better than cash. And again, historically, equities do beat cash over long terms, even when they're at more normal rates. Although I don't think anybody's expecting 5% interest rates anytime soon.
No.
And I think something to note there is that if you've got up to 18 years, you can use junior ISAs and bear trusts in a way that you just can't.
Yeah, I mean,
if you need the money sooner.
You're financially well enough off that you can afford to make these types of savings for children, for universities or private fees, or potentially even grandparents contributing, which that sort of the older generation tends to have a chunk of certainly property wealth, that the junior ISA is a great way to start. That they're separate to your own sort of ISA account, so you don't have to pay any capital gains tax. There's no income tax put onto your own account. Whereas if you set up a bear trust with designation, then the tax position still sits on your own account.
Yeah, and I think
you do need to be careful
on
capital gains, especially over an 18-year time period if you're making decent contributions.
But the same isn't true for grandparents, is it, with a bear trust? And that's quite an important difference there, I think, between, I believe, if you're opening a bear trust as a grandparent and more than £100 income on that investment is earned per year, the tax will not be put onto the grandparent, but it would be put onto the parent. So
that is correct. Again, but managing how these contributions are made, if it's in an account, most designations are via parents, but you do see some via grandparents. And the tax benefits of the junior ISA are quite clear. For me, the only downside of the junior ISA is at 18, the money is owned by the child,
and trust your child
may not behave as responsibly as you might like and use the money for university. But I think that's potentially a risk again worth taking for the sizable tax benefits that you might accrue over an 18 year period.
Would a sensible alternative be for the parents perhaps to use their own ISAs first of all to save for their children going to school or uni, and only when they sort of max out their allowance, which between them is 30k, then think about the junior ISA, which turns over to the child at 18?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm probably taking the liberty of presuming that if you've got the sort of finances to be able to make savings for children, that you probably have already done your own ISAs first. So yes, make use of a couple's ISA allowance, which is now just over 30,000. So that's a sensible thing to do. You then can use junior ISAs as well, which is an obvious next stage if you have extra money available on a monthly basis.
Okay, some really useful points there. Thanks for that. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. So it just remains to thank Darius McDermott, Managing Director at Chelsea Financial Services, and Carl Harald Jansen, Manager of International Biotechnology Trust. Thanks also to personal finance writer Kate Bealey. You can read more about saving for retirement and paying school fees in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening.